Good afternoon, folks, and welcome to this week's episode of the Legal Beagle Podcast. From time to time, we get asked about the taxability of someone's settlement or award if their case goes on to trial and they have a positive outcome. And it's a little tricky because the answer is a resounding maybe and possibly, depending on the claims that were made in the case that got settled or eventually produced an award. So I went out and found one of the top experts in our country regarding tax and the taxability of settlements and awards. In fact, our guest this week is Mr. Robert Wood from San Francisco, California. The law firm is Wood LLP. Robert has been featured across the country by various media outlets, including articles he's written in Forbes and being a contributor on Fox News. He's also written a book, Taxation of Damage Awards and Settlement Payments. He is probably one of the best person or people to go to ask about this question that we often get asked by our clients. So Robert, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So let's just dive right in, and I'm going to ask the umbrella question. Why is it important to know about the taxability of settlements and awards?
In general, any time that money is changing hands, whether it's a legal settlement or something else, there are potential tax issues. And so if somebody, a plaintiff, is receiving an amount, obviously they're typically well aware of what the legal fees are if it's a contingent fee case, for example. But when they're looking at their net amount, it's important to know if the net amount is before tax or after tax or some of both. So I'd say probably just about every plaintiff who's getting money wants to know what the tax treatment is.
So let's talk about that tax treatment. I know it has a lot to do with the origin of the claim. In fact, you referenced this as an important thing that should be considered, or at least the IRS will consider when looking at whether settlements and awards are taxed. What does it mean by the origin of the claim?
Yeah, it's kind of an annoying doctrine because it's cited in all the cases, and it gets applied by courts and by the IRS, but I don't think it's terribly easy to understand, or at least it's possible to come out different ways depending on your viewpoint. It basically means sort of what is the case all about? What are you trying to get? What are you trying to collect? What is your claim about, your legal claim? Because, for example, if it's about your employer shorted you and didn't pay you wages that he or she owes you, then it's easy to see that the amount that you collect in the settlement is probably wages. It's probably going to be treated the way it would have been treated had you gotten paid correctly in the first place. That's the concept, but most legal disputes are really messy and full of different claims, and so it's not always as straightforward as I just suggested.
So in that situation where someone were to get wages for monies owed to them, it makes sense to me that that would be taxed because you would be taxed anyway. What about a situation where, let's say someone's in a car crash and they get a combination of things? They get money for medical bills. They get money for lost wages for the time that they were out of work. And then they get money for pain and suffering. Looking at those three different categories, how would they be treated, or how could they be treated by the IRS?
Yeah, that's a great example because it sort of proves that what I just said is either not correct or at least subject to exceptions. So the PI case, the auto accident case, any kind of physical injury case, It's a good example. So your goal in such a case, I think the plaintiff's goal is not to pay tax on any of it. And that's probably realistic in that kind of a case. That is, there is a tax code section. It's one of the most sort of important in this area. It's section 104 of the Internal Revenue Code. And it basically says if you get a recovery for physical injuries or physical sickness, or related emotional distress, we'll come back to that topic, I'm sure, then it's tax-free. And the question you asked me about the wages that we discussed a moment ago, is sort of good to circle back to here, because as you said it, the victim of this crash, the plaintiff, gets one of the elements of damages is wage loss, money that he should have gotten because, you know, he was working and he couldn't go to work because of the accident. So in some ways you think, well, wait a minute, isn't that taxable? Shouldn't it be taxable as wages because it's really a substitute for the wages he would have gotten? But Section 104, this tax code section, basically says the origin of this claim is the auto accident. And sort of, it's true that somebody who has a very high paying job probably gets a larger auto accident recovery than somebody who has a low paying job, but that's not treated as wages. And if it's all compensatory, not punitive damages, it should all be tax-free in your example.
Why is there a difference between compensatory damages and punitive damages?
Yeah, it's historical. I mean, there have been arguments about this for decades. It was finally resolved in 1995, I think it was, when the tax code was amended to say that punitive damages are always taxed. And there was also a Supreme Court case about the same time that said the same thing. So there's sort of no more debate anymore. I don't know if it's fair or not, but the theory was that punitive damages by definition aren't to compensate you. So if in your car crash example, if you got injured and you get money for all of those injuries, that's compensatory, it's tax-free. But on the other hand, if you got a bunch more money for punitive damages because the automaker made a defective automobile and the jury wanted to punish the company, that's taxable because it's, again, the Supreme Court and Congress said punitive damages are never to compensate somebody. And of course, what this does, if you have a case that goes to jury and you have a verdict, it makes punitive damages a lot more painful, and it encourages settlement, I think. And there can be tricky issues when cases are settling on appeal.
Let's go back. In the beginning of the podcast, you said that if someone's hiring an attorney on a contingency basis, there may be different taxable amounts there. And I want to make sure I understand this, because I've heard two different things. I've heard one that if, let's say, the settlement is $100,000, total settlement, and the attorney got paid 40%, so 40,000 comes right off the top, the taxable amount to the client is 60,000. I've heard other people say, no, that's not right. It's the full 100,000. What do you say in that situation, Robert?
Yeah, this is one of these annoying, every plaintiff wants to know about this. And I'd say a lot of people think, probably correctly, that it's sort of counterintuitive. It really depends on the type of case. The Supreme Court, there's another Supreme Court tax case, decided this issue in 2005 in the case called Banks, B-A-N-K-S. And the Banks case, there were disputes for many decades over how legal fees, attorney's fees, would be treated in contingent fee cases. In Supreme Court case Banks in 2005, the court said, in your example, that's $100,000 payment to the client, even though the lawyer probably received this full settlement proceeds and then deducted his or her fee of $40,000 and sent $60,000 to the client. So the client probably only sees $60,000, certainly doesn't want to be taxed on any more than the $60,000. But the Supreme Court said, as a general rule, there are questions about whether there are exceptions here, but as a general rule, that's $100,000 of income or receipt to the client. That doesn't mean the client has to pay tax. In fact, generally speaking, it's possible for the client to deduct or offset somehow, but there's great debate on that, and it matters what kind of case it is. And it's been harder to do that since 2018.
Could that create a situation where there's almost double taxation going on, because the attorney arguably is going to pay taxes for sure on that 40%. So if, and I know you just discussed there are various exceptions and maybe there are workarounds that's the wrong word. There are things that could come into play that would change how much is actually taxed. But let's just say the client in that situation had $100,000 of income attributed to them, the attorney's got to pay tax on the 40%. Couldn't that possibly create some sort of double taxation?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I mean, I get phone calls from, you know, angry clients or prospective clients and angry lawyers, and they say that, you know, sometimes not as nicely as you just did. They say, you know, this is unconstitutional. It's unbelievable. It's double taxation. That's absolutely right. I mean, it's very common in the tax system for money to be taxed, you know, multiple times. And so, you know, it's clear, as you just said, the $100,000 comes in, and it's because of this bank's case. Let's assume it's all taxable. It's gross income to the client, the full 100. The lawyer has gross income on the 40. So that 40 is taxed to two different people. The goal, of course, is for the client to offset or deduct it somehow, which, as I say, usually is possible, but not always, which means, yes, it's possible that the same money is taxed to two different people. But so far, there's been no, you know, case that actually says that's unconstitutional and strikes it down.
Can you talk to me a bit about this concept of allocating damages? This is something you talked about in your Forbes article and why that might be beneficial and helpful in a situation where tax could be problematic. Can you just kind of explain that a little bit more?
Sure. So the one of the most important things in the tax treatment of settlements or judgments. And by the way, I mean, the same rules apply, the origin of the claim doctrine that you asked me about, and really most of the other concepts we'll talk about today are all equally applicable to settlements and judgments. But from my viewpoint as a tax lawyer, settlements are always better because there's always more flexibility. You really don't know what you're going to get. You know what the jury verdict says, but you don't know what kind of tax forms you're going to get. Sometimes you don't even know if the company is going to withhold taxes. So settlements are better in terms of shaping what you want. And one of the points that you want to think about is dividing the income up or dividing the payments up. What is it? Because very frequently it might be multiple things. You are in your auto accident. You mentioned medical expense, for example. But in a, let's say it's an employment dispute where you say, you have a bunch of discrimination claims. They paid you less. They treated you badly. These kinds of things. So often in employment cases, there's some amount that's wages that's subject to withholding, and then there's some amount that is on a form 1099, meaning no taxes are taken out. Kind of emotional distress money, for example, that's not wages. Sometimes there's lawyers' fees separately paid. And sometimes in employment cases, you're asking for some money to be treated as for personal physical sickness, physical injury. This happens a lot in sexual harassment type cases where someone is saying, I shouldn't have to pay tax at all on that amount. And it's good to try to iron that out at settlement time if you can.
Do the provisions that end up in a settlement agreement create any sort of binding requirement the IRS must follow? I almost feel silly asking you this question, but I've been asked by clients, so that's why I'm asking you.
It's not a silly question. I mean, I think it's you know, kind of sometimes when you're entering into a settlement agreement, I mean, it's a legal document. It's binding, and it's certainly binding on the parties. And so if the employer in that example says, we're not going to issue a 1099 for this, or we're going to withhold only on this $100,000 and not on that other $100,000. I mean, that's binding on the parties, but it does not bind the government. It doesn't bind the IRS. It doesn't bind the state tax authorities. But I'd still say it's important, and it sort of gives you a leg up, excuse me, on your preferred tax treatment.
What we are seeing more and more recently are confidentiality agreements in settlement agreements between parties. And there's a mixed opinion between the plaintiff's bar and the defense bar on whether there should be consideration paid for the confidentiality. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I would say that there's been a lot of confusion over confidentiality provisions or the tax treatment of them. First of all, I don't know that I've ever seen a settlement agreement in my long, many decade career as a tax lawyer, and I've seen a lot of settlement agreements. I don't know that I've ever seen one that doesn't have some kind of confidentiality provision. That sometimes they go on and talk about, not publishing anything or, not talking to the newspapers. Sometimes it's quite explicit, but there's always something that says it's private, at least in my experience. So I don't think you need to have a separate dollar amount stated. Sometimes people do that. I think a lot of the question on this came about because of a sort of an unfortunate tax case involving Dennis Rodman, which was about 15 or more years ago, called the Amos case, AMOS. That was the name of the plaintiff. So it was kind of a little PI case where a photographer, I think that's what Amos was, Dennis Rodman kicked him or pushed him out of the way or something like that at a basketball game. And the guy sued, and it settled for, as I recall, $200,000. And the court and the guy was kicked, I think kicked in the groin, as I remember, or at least that's what he alleged. And so the settlement agreement said $100,000 for being kicked in the groin, that's physical injury, shouldn't be taxed, and then $100,000 for confidentiality because Dennis Rodman's sort of handlers, wanted to make sure it wasn't discussed. And somehow that the IRS went after the 100 for confidentiality. And there's a tax case that says, well, that's not for the being kicked in the groin, that's taxable. So I think ever since then, there's been this fear that that confidentiality is taxable. And so sometimes people put in a really small dollar amount. I'm paying $100,000, I'm paying $500,000 to make the case go away, and I'm also paying, $50 or $5,000 for confidentiality. I think it's kind of silly to me. If it's 100%, sort of physical injury case, you just say everything's confidential. But I think the danger is if you start putting numbers. Some people want liquidated damages clauses. So, but there's no really easy answer. But I think that was the genesis of that whole line of worry.
I totally agree. In fact, that's the case that is discussed most often when this comes up, and whether there should be consideration and what the tax implication would be of that consideration if there was some taxable event after that.
And I'm only a tax lawyer, but one thing I would say is when I've seen people do that and say, well, look, we're only putting $50 for confidentiality because we only want to pay tax on $50. I would just say, well, but and I don't know this. This is sort of regular lawyer comments, which would be your department. But doesn't that mean that somebody could just violate it and then say, here you go, here's your $50? So I
It's
don't
a
know. It's but
fair
it's sort of
point.
a,
Yeah, I mean that's a
yeah.
really good point. It's like how strong is that confidentiality agreement if it was $50? When
Yeah.
it comes to lawyers that do not have the tax expertise that you do, they don't, and they want to make sure they're counseling their clients correctly. Clients are coming to them asking them these questions, and they want to say, "Look, I want to get you to the right person or the right people." Because I don't want to say the wrong thing and put you in a situation where you're upset with me a year from now when you're filing your taxes. What are your words of wisdom? How should that best be handled? How do you, as an attorney, so now we're speaking to our audience that are attorneys, and they're wanting to do the right thing. They don't want to mislead anyone. What kind of advice would you give them to put people in the best position to get the proper advice about these taxable events?
Yeah, there's no easy answer to that. And unfortunately, I mean, I've been an expert witness in sort of malpractice type cases. And I think on the sort of plaintiff side, which is a place where you'd usually see this, lawyers are, as you just said, I mean, trying to help the client. And I think it's a kind of a slippery slope. I mean, you don't want to say, I many people don't want to say, look, I have, if you mention the word tax, I can't talk to you. So I mean, taxes are always important. I think probably the best advice is to tell the client to get tax advice, try to connect them to someone. Of course, there's, I suppose, potential referral liability. But I think saying, look, I'm not a tax person, this person is, sort of you're on your own, but I'll try to cooperate any way I can. I think that's never a bad result. And I think what may be the worst mistake is a well-meaning one, which is to try to provide tax advice and then to do it incompetently. No matter how well-intentioned you are, that can obviously blow up in your face.
You mentioned emotional distress, and I read a lot about this because I was confused myself on how this becomes taxable. Can you talk a little bit more about that? And forget the origin of the claim now being a car crash. Let's just say emotional distress damages related to any other type of claim. Why would that be taxable, and how does that become kind of a red flag for people when it comes to a settlement involving emotional distress?
Sure, and by the way, I mean there's still confusion, lots of confusion from clients, but I'd say I get a fair number of queries from lawyers who seem surprised, who say things like, "Well, gee, we're treating that as emotional distress, so that's not taxable," and of course that statement is wrong or at least incomplete, and some of it is historical. So up until 1996, this is another one of these important dates. Up until 1996, Section 104, this tax code section I mentioned, said that personal injury damages and personal sickness, but personal injuries, money for personal injuries was tax-free. And in 1996, Congress changed the statute to say personal physical injuries. So it up. Until 1996, it was quite true that emotional distress money was non-taxable. That is no longer true. And when this statute was changed, I mean, it's maddening, but there really is still no definition in the tax code or from the IRS about exactly what physical means. But on the emotional distress point, when the tax code was changed in 96, there is a famous committee report, one of these big, in the old days, print thick reports, where Congress and the people writing the law said, when we say physical, we don't mean just emotional distress. Emotional distress isn't physical, and so things like even if you have physical symptoms like stomach aches, headaches, insomnia, those are emotional distress things, and we don't think they're physical. So that's actually in a footnote. So that's some important learning, but there's still a lot of gray area about exactly what's physical and what's merely emotional.
So when someone's unpacking all of this, and let's say they're bringing a claim for all these different forms of damages, is this where getting a tax attorney involved to help them understand the different, what'd you call it, the allocation of damages, or just understanding why some of these may be taxable, some may not, but here's some guidance in that issue?
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, there's not taxes to be saved in every single case, but in most cases there are. And sometimes it's as simple as, back to the 100,000, the legal fee issue, the $100,000 and $40,000 example. I mean, sometimes it's simply to make darn sure that someone knows whether it's clear that the legal fees are deductible or not, and if so, how deductible. But certainly in terms of the physical injury exclusion, it's almost always worth getting some advice. And back to your sort of malpractice question about what lawyers should do. I mean, some lawyers, many lawyers, most lawyers, I guess, will say, look, we're not tax people. We can't give you tax advice, but you should get some. Some go a step further and say, and here's one or here's three you could call. And some go a step further than that and say, look, I can't provide tax advice, but to make sure that you're getting advice, I'm willing to pay for an hour of time with so and so. I think that's a little uncommon, but some people do it. But in any case, making sure that the client knows to get ahead of it is smart.
I read this settlement taxability form. You won't be able to see it on your screen, but it's from the IRS publication, and it talks about the taxability of settlements. I'm sure you've seen it. One of the things I found very interesting as it related to medical expenses is whether or not there was an itemized deduction taken. And it makes sense to me when I read through this why that would be taxable or non-taxable depending on the deduction. But can you explain to our audience why that would be a factor to be considered as they look at their settlements?
Sure. So I mean, it's a, and I'm familiar with that document. There's an IRS publication that's called something like Lawsuit Settlements Audit Guide. And it's essentially for IRS people about how they should audit this issue. So it's worth looking at. And the IRS updates it periodically. Excuse me, the issue you're asking about, I guess, is something that I would lump into a tax doctrine called the tax benefit rule. So basically that means, as the name kind of suggests, it essentially means if you got a tax benefit for something, then that may get recaptured. So if you've been deducting medical expenses, for example, on your tax return, and typically that means probably big medical expenses, and then you get reimbursed for those, you know, down the road at some point, some years later in a settlement, the IRS can look back at those prior tax returns and see that you deducted them. So even though normally this kind of thing wouldn't be taxed, they're going to recapture the tax benefit that you got from the past. That's the concept.
Gotcha. There is a section in this same publication that may put some of our listeners to sleep, but I think this is fascinating and I wanted to explore it with you. It's talking about loss and value of property. We're getting into basis points. We often bring what are called diminished value claims on behalf of clients. And this is a situation where a client's vehicle gets damaged. It isn't a total loss, but now the vehicle is worth less than it was worth at the time of the crash. This comes into play, and the taxability of this comes into play. Can you explain, just maybe in a layperson's way, how adjusted basis works and why this needs to be important when someone recaptures a loss in value on their property?
Sure. So, and it's a great point. It is a little confusing, or it can be, and it comes up in a variety of types of cases. But essentially, for example, investment loss type cases, where you had a brokerage account and you had $500,000 in it, and the broker mismanaged it or something, and you it's now down to 200, and you get some of that money back. It's kind of your own money. Is there some tax on that? And the answer would be it kind of depends. For example, was your basis, the concept you just raised, Jonathan, is your basis $500,000, or was your basis zero, meaning you hadn't paid tax on any of this and you get some money back? So it's, you need to know things like basis. If you had a basis, just to use your example, if you have a basis of $50,000, you paid for your car, it's damaged and it's now worth $20,000, and you get a settlement, they're going to give you $10,000 toward your car. I would say your basis was 50 and now it just went down to 40 because you got a payment that you could treat as income, but I think it would be fair in that example to say it's not really income because it's just a recovery of some of my basis in my car, the 50,000 I originally spent. That same concept applies in a lot of other kinds of property cases, like construction defect cases. You know, I had you build this house for me. It's now, it's now defective in certain ways. I paid X for it. It's now worth less than X. I want to get reimbursed. And most people wouldn't want to have to treat that as income.
I'm going to ask you an off the wall question because I got asked this and I have to know from your perspective what you think. This client, we were trying to prove up wages and a wage loss, and the defense attorneys wanted to look at tax returns. And the client said, if Trump doesn't have to disclose his tax returns, neither do I. Now, I understand from a perspective of we have the burden, we have to prove that. But forget that for a minute, Robert. What is your thought on the confidentiality or privacy or whatever it may be called as it relates to tax returns? And I'm not talking about Trump now. I'm just talking in general about people saying, my tax returns are private. I don't have to share those. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I think the your client's right. I mean, there are fights. I would say, in cases that I'm advising on, or in some cases that I'm an expert witness on, which may not be a malpractice case, it may be some kind of other dispute, contract dispute, where there are tax issues that I'm supposed to address. But I'd say a lot of times, as a lawyer, if I'm involved in a case, I would say things like, gee, do we have tax returns? Because they always tell you something. But a majority, at least in my experience, majority of the time, defendants can't get plaintiffs' tax returns precisely because of the privacy. And I suppose Trump probably helped that, effort, as you say, because it's, more than a few people would say, heck, if Trump doesn't have to do it, I don't either. I think, and very frequently when I have seen them in cases, it's, they've been heavily redacted. So if my understanding, this really isn't a tax point, but my understanding is if the plaintiff has directly put an issue in sort of controversy, for example, that the tax return is sort of the best evidence of that, then they can be fair game in some redacted portion, or form. But anyway, I think that's my answer, at least.
Well, I appreciate that. I end every podcast with what I call the fast five. These are just five fast questions that are kind of off the wall. Will you indulge me and participate in the fast five? All right, Robert, number one, have you read the entire tax code?
No.
It's a big tax code. I took federal tax in law school and I looked at that thing and I was like, holy cow. I think we had the abbreviated version. Robert, name something you wish you were better at.
Oh, gosh. Summarizing complex rules.
Don't we all? If you could use only one utensil for the rest of your life, which one would you pick?
I'm gonna assume we're talking about eating utensils, and I guess I would pick a fork.
Yeah, probably the most functional. You could tear things apart even if you didn't have a knife. Give me one of your pet peeves.
Oh, gosh. I don't have too many, so I'm not sure how to answer that one. Or maybe I've got so many that I can't narrow it down.
It's another way to look at it. Final question. If you had a yacht, what would you name it?
Boy, I'm not a sailor. I guess I would name it, Liberty.
Liberty. I love that.
I don't know why.
Yeah. It's one of the tenets of our country. I'd written down SS taxation. I thought that would be fitting with the work that you've done over the years. Yeah, Robert Wood, thank you.
I was just going to say, I can tell you the title of the name of the yacht would definitely not be a tax term.
You're probably too close to it in your professional life to have it be on a boat in your personal life. Robert Wood, thank you so much for joining the Legal Beagle podcast. Your insight is extremely helpful. I hope it provides some guidance for those that get to watch this podcast and will watch it for years to come. If people want to get in touch with you, I will put up your website here on this podcast so they can reach you that way. I appreciate the time today, Robert. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.